Welcome to 7 Things EMS, a continuing education offering from Limmer Education. 7 Things EMS is designed to give you what you need to succeed in EMS. It's conversational, informational, and without the fluff. All right, and welcome to another 7 Things EMS episode. Maybe I say this every time, but we're going to have a great episode today. We're going to talk about sepsis. There was a time that sepsis wasn't really in the EMS conversation, but now it is. One of the people that's helped put that in this conversation is our guest for this session, Rom Duckworth. Rom is a captain and EMS coordinator for the Ridgefield Fire Department in Connecticut, EMS educator, conference speaker, and an advisory board member for the Sepsis Alliance, which brings us to him today. Rom, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Dan. I love any opportunity to talk to you and any opportunity to talk about sepsis. So there you go.
We've been doing this for a long time, and the mantra of this is, let's get into it. So I think that's what we're going to do. So number one, let's define sepsis. I think that's a really great start. Why don't you give it to us so we can all understand sepsis a little bit better?
Absolutely. The CDC's definition of sepsis, and normally when you say that, people start to freeze up, but it hits all of the marks in just a few words. It's the body's overwhelming and life-threatening response to infection. And they go on to say it can lead to tissue damage, organ failure, and death. But the key word there is the one in the middle, response. And you can think of it kind of like anaphylaxis. We wouldn't get somebody who was having an anaphylactic reaction to, say, a bee sting and say, oh, this person's suffering a bee venom overdose, or anything like that. It's the body's inappropriate response. So people tend, with the definition, to focus on the infection part. And it always begins with infection, but the fact that it's the body's overwhelming and life-threatening response makes it a lot of ways like anaphylaxis.
Wow. Okay. I get that. And I see we're going to talk about some physiology and pathophysiology in a little bit. So I'll hold off on some of the questions that I know people have here, because I think we'll get into it. But let's talk about EMS. And I think we'll do the 1-2 ones really quickly here. You say number two, EMS makes a difference in sepsis. How do we make a difference?
Honestly, in great ways. And that was exactly the question that originally brought me to the Sepsis Alliance, because like you, I've been doing this for a while, and when I first took my EMT and paramedic programs, they referred to sepsis in ways kind of like they did refer to cancer. It's something that you're going to encounter, but it's not anything that you're going to fix or do anything about on the way to the hospital. It's just something that patients have sometimes, and it's bad. And as I went on in my career, as you say, people were talking more and more about sepsis, and I wound up going to this organization, the Sepsis Alliance, and say, you know, really two things. I want to understand sepsis better for myself because I have questions, but I also want to understand how relevant sepsis is to EMS. You know, if it's not really relevant, I just want to learn about it, so I'll keep it to myself. But they were the ones who were able to tell me that we pre-hospital clinicians transport more than 50% of patients with sepsis, and the patients that EMS encounters that have sepsis tend to be older and sicker. So it's definitely a problem that we are encountering on a regular basis, whether we're recognizing it or not as often as we should. But the flip side is also important. They were able to let me know that sepsis education and using sepsis pre-hospital alerts, whatever you call them, whatever it's a sepsis, code sepsis, sepsis alert, whatever, they cut the time to treatment in half. They cut the patient's mortality in half. They decrease the length of hospital stay. They have all sorts of downstream effects that are important in terms of healthcare, although they may not be as meaningful to you and me at EMS. They decrease the cost of the patient's stay, just tons of things further down that affect healthcare overall, because so many patients have sepsis, but they also affect patients' lives in ways that I wish we got a better chance to see in EMS, because the improved outcome isn't just, you know, a little tick box and an attaboy for an individual EMT or paramedic. This is a human life, it's a patient, and it's all of the people that are the loved ones and friends and family of these patients. So EMS really does make a difference for all these patients we're encountering. And if we recognize and treat sepsis properly, we can really not fix things necessarily. You can't, you know, cancel sepsis. You're not going to cure it, but you make a huge difference.
I think one of the things that you said in there really resonates with me. As EMS grows and matures, we do have to realize that we have a place in the healthcare system and that things that we do make a difference. You know, we start even starting precautionary lines and the cost for the patient and all the little things that we do and how they affect things, as you said, downstream. We consider ourselves kind of an island, a little misunderstood. We're a little bit outside of the system. But I don't think we really are. And I really like that point about how things we do make a difference farther down the line in the system.
I want to thank you for saying that, Dan. And just as a quick personal thing, between you and me, but that I think anybody who listens to Seven Things regularly probably already picking up on. My early encounters with EMS educators were very much, they were the handers down of knowledge. You know, they were just help me acquire the memorize and then use the stuff that was in the textbook. And when you and I years ago began having conversations, I liked you personally, but as got excited as an educator speaking with somebody else who thought, well, yeah, we have to make sure people have the knowledge and can practice the skills, but also need to change their attitudes and sometimes just the way that they're looking at things and the way that they're thinking about things. And it can so often involve undoing. It's not just we're handing over information, but sometimes we have to undo the information that some of our EMTs and medics get exposed to that, you know, will make a difference between here and the front door of the hospital, and that's about it. And you're right, that just in 30-something years, I've learned the impact that's further down. We have so much more of an impact that I think most people realize. And I'm glad you're helping to change minds about that.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let's get into, we can be philosophic all we want, but I think people now are looking for some physiology. I think that the inflammatory response, the things that really make sepsis, aren't the best understood. And I think that we're talking about first the physiology, then we'll get into the pathophysiology. I think there's a lot of people, the meat and potatoes people, are saying, this is what I'm here for.
Okay. Well, honestly, me too. And it could be really overwhelming when you start looking at the immune system, because the immune system by itself, before it even starts to connect with all of the other systems in the body, can be really overwhelming. The way I wrap my head around it is, number one, you already mentioned the inflammatory response. So one thing that we need to understand before we even walk in is that the immune system and the inflammatory response are tied together. They go one with the other. And as we step through it, you'll see how and why. But I like to start by thinking about the innate immunity. That's like the first responders. That's not the stuff that's involved in vaccinations or prior exposure to antigens or anything like that. The innate immunity is like the first responders. They're just chemicals and cells and proteins that are floating around in your body right now, just keeping an eye out for something bad. And some of these are complement proteins and toll-like receptors. And these are just like bits and bobs of stuff. They're not individual cells. They're floating around and they're activated by antigens and pathogens. So stuff in your body that shouldn't be there, that's going to make somebody sick, the complement proteins and toll-like receptors stick onto them. And they can begin doing stuff called opsonization, which is they're just melting down these bacteria or fungi or virus-infected cells, cancer-disturbed cells, anything along those lines, parasites. They'll just start to melt it down. But they'll also attract those first responder innate immunity cells, like macrophages. And they're like the dispatchers, okay? So they take that initial call, they recognize there's a problem, these complement proteins and toll-like receptors, they'll begin their initial response, and they'll call for the ambulance. That's the macrophage. Macrophages come in, they start to consume these antigens, these pathogens, these, you know, yucks. And when the macrophages of different kinds start chewing this stuff up, they break it down, and the macrophages release cytokines. And these are messenger proteins that go out to the rest of the body, basically calling for mutual aid. And they call out for a greater immune response to a particular area. So those complement proteins and toll-like receptors are taking the first calls, starting things off. Macrophages of different kinds, naturals, killer cells, and others start to digest this stuff. And they're sending out the radio call with these cytokines. And these are supposed to call other immune components to an area. But you said it. They also initiate the inflammatory response in that area. So if you think about an infection, you cut your hand, you get an infection in your hand, that part of your hand might start to swell up. You get an inflammatory response. That's because not only are we calling mutual aid, are we calling in for additional resources, additional immune resources to the area, but picture it like the inflammatory response is actually opening up the roadway. It's a one-lane road in here. Well, we're going to do vasodilation. We're going to make it a 2 or a 3-lane road. Well, that'll get you here. But once you get here, you're going to have to get off the highway and you're going to have to take a couple of back roads to get where the actual emergency is, where the actual infection is. You have to get out of the circulatory system and you have to get into the meat. And so these macrophages releasing cytokines, these chemicals, will inflame and cause the capillaries to actually become leaky so that the incoming immune components can get there more quickly by the vasodilated circulatory system and then leak out of the circulatory system on purpose in that area to get in there and begin fighting whatever the infection happens to be. Later on, if it's an infection that we've identified before, or after 3 or 4 days of fighting an infection, the immune system starts to get further information on that infection and can mount a specific response. And that winds up getting a little bit more complicated down the road. But what we need to know about sepsis is really all of this stuff in that first response, that innate immunity.
Wow. All right. Well, it obviously, when we go from physiology to number 4, to pathophysiology, obviously things go bad. It becomes more systemic. It becomes, you know, really a major part of the patient's presentation. I think we have to talk about the presentation too, about what we see in those patients in this. So let's do pathophysiology. Let's continue down this very dangerous path.
Okay, so we know sepsis is triggered by an infection. So all of the stuff that I mentioned before, whatever the source of the infection, that's all what happens. The complement proteins, toll-like receptors do their thing, start activating stuff. Just like we think of anaphylaxis, here's where we get the pathophysiology as the body's inappropriate, overwhelming, incorrect response. Instead of just fighting the infection in one place, and again, I want to make one more analogy here real quickly with anaphylaxis. We don't see a patient who's having an anaphylactic reaction to a bee sting and think, well, they must have been stung by a whole swarm of bees. I mean, you would never think, well, in order to have anaphylaxis, if you're allergic to peanuts, you have to eat a whole jar of peanut butter. Otherwise, there's no way that you could have anaphylaxis. We would never think of it that way. Well, the immune system is just the same way. It doesn't have to be a giant, overwhelming infection. It can be any infection that starts the cascade that I already described. That's when the body has its inappropriate reaction, just like it does in anaphylaxis, that instead of just responding with these chemical messengers calling immune system components to the site of the infection, they start going everywhere. It's the domino effect throughout the whole body. The inflammatory response that's supposed to only be where the infection is starts to occur everywhere. So if you get this cut in your hand, all of a sudden you're getting an inflammatory response that's causing vasodilation across the whole body. And we're dropping down the relative volume in the blood vessels, right? We're making the container bigger. But it's more than that. The inflammatory response is also causing the blood vessels to leak out. So we're not just getting a relative hypovolemia, we're getting an actual hypovolemia. And we're activating immune components all over the body. And some immune components are, like I said, these initial ones, the innate immunity, is not always specific to the infection. It'll come in and just start blowing up everything. I mean, think of it like that the crazy guy in one of the Alien movies is going in and shooting and throwing grenades at everything to, we're going to nuke it from space. It's the only way to be sure. They just destroy everything, including healthy cells. So this response, when it's pathophysiological, is also ripping apart good parts of the body. Now, it's happening on the micro scale, so it's very easy to miss. But throughout the whole body, capillaries are not only leaking, but they're starting to rip and tear, which means it's triggering bleeding. And bleeding is going to trigger the clotting mechanism. So now clotting is happening all over the body. As the blood pressure is dropping, clotting is starting to happen throughout capillaries all over the place. So circulation overall is getting worse. It's leaking out. It's third spacing. While there is this inflammatory response causing swelling to occur in all different parts of the body. So not only is there less pressure in the circulatory system, but the swelling and the inflammatory response and the fluid leaking is further squeezing in on these low pressure capillaries. So it's just shutting circulation off everywhere. And this microbleeding that's starting to happen triggers the clotting cascade all over the body. We can start to get something called disseminated intravascular coagulation. And it's exactly what it says on the label. It's disseminated throughout the body, intravascular. So it's throughout the circulatory system, but you know, it's small. So it's mostly in the capillaries and it's coagulation, it's clotting. And you would think that's bad enough. We got the drop in blood pressure, we're leaking, we're squeezing on the blood vessels, we're clotting all over the place. But then remember that our clotting mechanism, our clotting cascade, only has a certain amount of clotting chemicals floating throughout the body. So if you activate all of them throughout the body, all at the same time, you use them all up. So now we go from clotting unnecessarily to not being able to clot if we need it. And there's more and more. We could certainly spend a huge amount of time if we wanted to really digging into it. But you can see how instead of the site of the infection, it's the whole body where we get that acquired infection, blood vessel problems leading to circulatory collapse.
I think that's an outstanding. I love your explanation, the way you make it very understandable. I think people are really going to get this. Now, are there certain infections, certain things that you're more likely to develop sepsis from? Are certain populations more likely to develop sepsis?
That's a fantastic question. And it's a challenging one to answer because I think most of the time people misunderstand, and this is what creates a big sepsis myth, they misunderstand the answer to that. So first I have to say that it can be an infection anywhere. There was a young man, an unfortunately famous or infamous case in New York City of a young man named Rory Staunton, who was a young, healthy kid, and he was out playing basketball, and he wound up just getting a scrape playing basketball. And it was hardly an infection at all. He was healthy. He didn't have any significant medical history. It's just a young, athletic kid, and his body responded to the infection with this inappropriate response, this overwhelming response, and nobody recognized it because one of the potential factors was a young, healthy kid. Sepsis or infections like this, they kill be a big problem to, you know, a weaker, older person, somebody with a compromised immune system or something like that. So it is true that older patients, the very old, the very young, patients with compromised immune system, such as patients undergoing cancer treatment, patients with indwelling catheter, so anything that may puncture the skin or anything that may make it more likely for someone to get infection. If they're more likely to get infected, or they're more likely to fall into shock, then they're more susceptible to septic shock. Absolutely. And that should, those patients like that should be, sepsis should be high up on your differential diagnosis if they have any kind of an infection. But I don't want to say that in any way that makes people think, oh, well, then that means that a young, healthy kid or a fit 20-year-old kid won't be able to get one, because that's simply not true. And likewise, 50% of sepsis infections happen because they're respiratory infections. So half of it's a respiratory infection. When I encounter one, I'm thinking, well, this respiratory infection certainly isn't doing this patient any good, and I need to deal with the respiratory infection in front of me. If they're hypoxic, if they need help breathing, whatever I need to do. But sepsis floats very quickly up to the top of my differential diagnosis that a patient is allowed to have more than one thing wrong with them. But I never want to flip it around and think, well, it's just a cut on the hand, so it can't be sepsis, because sepsis has to be an overwhelming infection, or they have to have a burning hot fever, or they have to have a huge, you know, really terrible pneumonia, and they need to be older. Yeah, they do get that more often, but these young, these healthy patients, you know, again, you wouldn't say, well, I'm not worried about anaphylaxis because they have to be older and infirm and have 10 other things wrong with them before anaphylaxis can, you know, be a problem. It's again, it's not a perfect analogy, but I want to take something that we tend to know and understand better than sepsis and help us wrap our heads and break open some myths about sepsis.
You know, I think that people that have been out there for a while before sepsis became a very common word in EMS, remember the calls they had that made them say, oh, wow, I had a guy, had a procedure for a prostate cancer, developed a UTI. And then one day he just didn't get out of bed. And his wife said he's not himself. And he was a little slow to answer questions. But lying in bed, his respiratory rate was 18. And at the time, I will admit, I didn't quite put it together. I knew that there was an infection. I know urinary tract infections can do it. But that altered mental status, the rapid respirations, the, you know, I think EMS people have to, when they think about it, you mentioned differentials. The concept of even looking for that wound, the concept of asking the right questions to get there, is a really important part of this. And I can remember that call as the one that made the light bulb come on for me many, many years ago for sepsis.
It's so funny that you say that, because I had a similar moment, not about a particular call, but just getting involved with the Sepsis Alliance and having them explain some of this stuff to me and looking at some of the statistics. And you know, often even big numbers can make your eyes roll back in your head. But it really made me have to confront, you know, hey, I've been doing this for a while. How many patients? Like, it's got to be, it's a statistic inevitability that I had patients that maybe I recognized were sick, but didn't recognize that it was sepsis because I didn't know and understand. And I missed opportunities to treat and advocate for them. And maybe there were other patients that I really didn't even have an idea of how sick they were because I didn't understand how sepsis, unlike anaphylaxis, where you walk into the room and maybe you hear them wheezing and they're in a tripod position and they've got the welts all over their face and bodies like they were attacked by a giant squid, you know? And so anaphylaxis, sometimes you could see it from across the room, but because sepsis works on this micro level, eating away at all of the organ function that if you're not really looking for it, like you say, it's so easy to miss. You can spot it if you're looking for it, but if you're not really paying attention and you're not bringing your A game with your assessment and asking all of the questions and doing all of the assessment that you can, you're just going to miss out. And you shouldn't presume that just dropping them off at the hospital, well, they're going to find it, because there is no magic test for sepsis. There's no blood test. There's no biomarker. There's no nothing. All there is assessment. And that's why as clinicians overall, not just EMTs and paramedics, but even in the emergency department, critical care and beyond, we tend to be terrible at spotting sepsis because we're busy, we're overworked, we're seeing a lot of patients, and it can be easy not to always bring your best. But here's an example of when you really, really need to. This patient's going to slip by.
Wow. Well, let's go on to number five. I think we're doing really well in this. This is flowing. I love it. Number five is the patient's chart. And that's something tells me you've got a mnemonic or something you're gonna lay on us and is going to help us even more.
I will. Now, I'm not always a huge fan of mnemonics because some of us get mnemonic fatigue in classes, and I understand it. But what I find is when we do something like this and we kind of want to do it as a train the trainer, I find that they can make things easy to recall and pass on. So this isn't for everybody, you know, this isn't for listeners at 3 o'clock in the morning on a dark and stormy night while sitting next to a sick little old lady. This is just to help wrap our head around the process. So we know if I were to bring up any kind of case study, any kind of patient example right now, we're doing seven things about sepsis. So we already know what this patient has. But in the real world, of course, we don't. And the idea with sepsis is when you don't think you're going to have it, or you know, when you're not really thinking about sepsis already, it could be easy to slip by. So the chart is the patient, the way we go through dealing with the patient, starting with the patient's complaint. C, complaint. Any kind of complaint that the patient has that's related to infection or shock, sepsis. It's not always sepsis, but sepsis needs to be on the table. I always think about it in my mind like I've got a stack of cards, 3x5 cards, with all the different things that could be wrong with this particular patient. And if the patient says to me anything about having an infection, sepsis moves up towards the top of that deck. Doesn't mean it's the only thing wrong with the patient, doesn't mean it's the top thing wrong with the patient, but I move it up on my list of things that might be going on here right with the patient, with the complaint. And then I start asking a patient questions about their history. So complaint, then history, CH. What can we find out about their infection? Or if they haven't yet mentioned infection, what might lead them to be someone who is more likely to have infection? Like, I had an infection recently, but it's not really bothering me as much. Or, my grandmother had that urinary tract infection, but she stopped taking the antibiotics before the end because it seemed like it was getting better and she doesn't really like taking that many pills. Things like that. Anything with the history for, again, infection or shock. If it's a cardiac patient, I'd be primarily doing my cardiac assessment. I'm doing my cardiac workup and all of that. But if I'll still, because I'm the sepsis guy, I'm going to ask a question about, hey, anything else going on recently? Been feeling okay? Just trying to catch anything on the periphery, sepsis or not, that may be relevant. And if they say anything about an infection, okay, again, cardiac, certainly acute coronary syndromes, myocardial infarction is the little 3x5 card that I have at the top of my deck. But now I pull sepsis out and I move that up there too so I don't forget about it. Because again, a patient can have more than one thing going on. Maybe they are having a myocardial infarction, but maybe it's related to this infection that's causing their circulatory system to not work as well or put more strain on the heart that they've had that's been sick for years. So complaint, history, and we're already moving into assessment. So CHA for assessment. And this is going to be different for every provider, depending on where they work, what their level of certification is, what their level of experience is. Some are going to be doing blood tests. Others are going to be doing, you know, blood pressure, systolic over diastolic. Others are going to be looking at mean arterial pressure. So assessment is just the big catch-all for making sure that you're using all of the tools at your disposal. Entitle CO2 as a good surrogate for helping to identify not just the patient's breathing, but also their circulatory status, along with their blood pressure and pulse rate and strength. And so assessment is the whole catch-all. of, well, now I really need to get the big picture. Complaint and history have provided some context for me. So I've got an idea of some things that may be going on with this patient. Now I'm going to get all of the numbers. And with the context of complaint and history, that assessment, all of those vital signs are going to help me get a better understanding. And without the complaint and the history, and for me, my little stack of cards, I can get a whole bunch of numbers, but I may not know what they mean. And sometimes when I hear other providers give a report face-to-face or over the radio, I'm thinking, well, you did an assessment, but you didn't do anything with it, because I'm hearing you just regurgitate a whole bunch of numbers, and I don't think they mean anything to you, because you're not giving, you know, that headline. You're not getting those red flags pop. You're not seeing those red flags. And for chart, that's the next thing. We got our complaint and our history. And as we're looking at the assessment, we're looking at those red flags. A pulse rate that's higher than normal. A respiratory rate that's higher than normal. Abnormal lung sounds. End-tidal CO2 that's below 35. Now, the red flags can be any abnormal vital signs, just off the bat. And I can say that after working with a whole bunch of other smart people and writing several chapters on sepsis. Really, there's no definitive, these are the, you know, seven red flags that you need to hit. It can be anything. Your mileage may vary depending on what your local sepsis alert is or protocol. But you need to be looking for those red flags, any assessment items that are out of whack. And that'll lead both to our sepsis alert and our treatment. And that's the final T in chart. So complaint, history, providing the context for that rock star assessment. We get all of the, you know, number, shapes, and colors that we can on our assessment for our vital signs. And we go and look for those red flags, which may sound simplified, but again, at 3 o'clock in the morning on a dark and stormy night with a patient with a complex medical history, I try and keep it to this so I can go, okay, this isn't normal, this isn't normal, this isn't normal. And within the history and the complaint, what red flags am I seeing and what treatment needs to start addressing those red flags?
You get, you know, those aha moments are important. You know, recognizing those red flags are the ones that make you go, oh, this could be whatever the diagnosis is. But in sepsis, I can see those. Now, ultimately, what we're going to do is we're going to have certain treatments. Now, treatment's number seven. But before we get there, we're going to call an alert in. We're going to let people know. We're going to start to prepare about this. So number six, moving on from this, and these are going to continue to go, is the sepsis alert. Do you think people hesitate calling alerts like that? Are they nervous?
Absolutely. I think they do. And in different systems, it can be for different reasons. I've heard a lot of things expressed, but probably the number one is, well, I call a sepsis alert and I don't really see anything magical happening. It's not like calling a trauma alert where a whole bunch of people run into the room. So it feels like it doesn't do anything. And then afterwards, I never really hear anything about it. I may not get the feedback on a sepsis alert like I do sometimes on a trauma alert or a cardiac alert or a cardiac arrest. So it can make people think that it doesn't really do anything. But what you're doing is identifying this patient like, hey, here's a patient in your emergency department that could fly under the radar. So let's just make sure that they're getting the attention that they need. It's not a, I have diagnosed sepsis and all must listen to me. You know, it really is just a, hey, we need to work together pre-hospital and in hospital to make sure this patient doesn't fly under the radar until the sepsis has eroded their organ function so much that they just collapse into shock and there's no bringing them back. Because once that happens with sepsis, as we talked about in the pathophysiology, you've got nothing to work with. You can start pumping fluid in. You can start doing this. You can start doing that. And it's not to say that those things aren't worth trying, but we need to give the sepsis alert early on. Infection plus bad vitals equals sepsis. Infection plus shock equals septic shock, or whatever your individual sepsis alert or code sepsis is. And we need to make sure we catch that early, and we can do that while we're moving on to treatment. But if we miss the sepsis alert, the treatment that we do or the treatment they receive in the hospital just may be far too late.
All right. And that takes us to number seven. And I think this is, there's a lot here. So we have a little bit of time left. Learn the ABCDs of sepsis treatment.
And this is an easy one in a way, because this is the mnemonic that everybody already knows, right? Airway, breathing, circulation, and drugs in this case. So the A and B always work together, right? We know that. Airway or whatever tube or piece of plastic we're going to stick in a patient's orifice is really only for the purpose of ventilating those alveoli. The only thing that really is the working part of the respiratory system, where the respiratory meets cardiovascular, right, in the alveoli. So we start with A, with airway, and it's not to say that every patient with sepsis needs a tube or even needs definitive airway management. Many can manage their own airway. But I start with A because if it's a patient who's struggling to maintain their airway, we may, or I do, lean towards intubation as the airway management selection of choice, because many times these are patients who require really 100% control of their respirations. They require high pressures of ventilation. As I said, more than 50% of patients who have sepsis have a respiratory infection. So again, not everybody needs a plastic tube down their throat just because they have sepsis. But if I'm looking at someone and I think, oh man, I'm going to have to help them with their airway, or I'm going to have to help them breathe or breathe for them, then I pull the trigger a little bit more quickly. I'm a little more assertive with endotracheal intubation because I think I'm going to need to be ventilating them. And that goes from the airway to the B for breathing. We need to reduce this patient's work of breathing because a couple of things are happening. Very often, and just like everybody, again, one more time, I'll reach back to anaphylaxis. Everybody has anaphylaxis a little bit differently. Some are primarily skin signs. Some are skin signs along with respiratory. Some are less respiratory, but more they go into shock, right? Sepsis can be the same way, can present different ways, right? So they don't always need that ventilatory support in the breathing, but we are going to aim for reducing their work of breathing. And if it's just a little bit of supportive oxygen, that's great. But if they need more, again, I'm thinking, hey, this is sepsis. If I'm recognizing almost anything, it means it's probably already worse than it looks to me. So I tend to be more assertive with our ventilation. If I'm thinking about helping to bag this patient, we're bagging this patient. I just move quickly towards it. And I make sure that the crew who's working with me, that we're all on the same page with that. Similarly, circulation. These patients tend to need fluids, and they tend to need fluids fast. We need to help start refilling the circulatory system to keep it going. However, it's not just an uncontrolled dumping of fluids into the patients. So we say they're already leaking, they're swelling, so it really has to be a balance. We want to get those fluids in fast. But just like you said, Dan, we have to think down the road too. Once the patient's in the hospital, even if we did a good job and gave exactly the right amount of fluids, which again, may be a lot, they're going to have to deal with it down the road. Those fluids are not staying in the circulatory system. They're going to have to be eventually, you know, processed out. So we need the patient to be kept alive enough, and fluids can help support that long enough to get the rest of the treatment that they need. But we can't just indiscriminately go, well, you know, Rom Duckworth said, or anybody said, the protocols say we got to dump fluids into this patient because sepsis patients need a lot of fluids. We have to make sure that we're still assessing the patient every step of the way and being cautious and watching that. Again, be prepared. They may need a lot, but check them each step of the way. And D for drugs, if they're hypoglycemic, correct that. If they're hypocalcemic, they may need bicarbonate or whatever else your protocols are saying about different medications. You don't want to forget that. If they have a respiratory problem and we need to be helping giving them medications for that, that's fine. If antibiotics are on the table for you, they're within your protocols, then that may be appropriate. But the number one drug, drug that we may give, supports those fluids. So we're going to give the fluids, and if the fluids are starting to help, but maybe not quite getting us where we want to be, then we're going to consider pressors. And we're thinking norepinephrine as the number one presser in sepsis for complex physiological reasons that would probably bore anybody for the rest of the podcast. But it really is sort of, it hits all of the marks. And again, here's one where just like epinephrine is a great drug, it's almost like it was built for anaphylaxis. Here, norepinephrine, for the most part, does really, really well in sepsis. Whereas epinephrine, in our departure from our anaphylaxis analogy, epi is really further down on the list. It could be used as a presser, but norepi over epi by far.
All right. So brings a couple of questions. First of all, for the EMTs listening, this might be, depending on your transport time or whatever, might be an indication for flight, who can do some of these things, or an ALS intercept, certainly an alert getting them to the right place. Continuing on for the ALS people, would I be correct in saying that the Sepsis Alliance, if my memory is good here, wants a mean arterial pressure of at least 65? Is that something that's part of that? And then part of our goal is to get there? And I'll just throw one more question. Is there a specific fluid recommendation? Now, I know EMS tries to hang their hat on things too much. Obviously, we don't want to blindly follow. We don't want to start hanging bag after bag after bag meaninglessly. But a little more guidance in the fluid and the mean arterial pressure, I think, would be really great here.
Sure. So you're absolutely right. Now, I get a chance to, because I try to be sharp on exactly, you know, who recommended what numbers. But I also try to be very practical. Again, that sort of dark and stormy night, 3 o'clock in the morning, right? Next to a little old lady, and I'm remembering back. So for mean arterial pressure, they do want a mean arterial pressure of 65 or greater, or a systolic blood pressure of 90 or greater. But mean arterial pressure, better overall measurement of the patient's circulatory status. For those of you doing shock index, that's great. Technically, the number for shock index, you want a shock index, which is a 0.8 or greater. But really, anything is a shock index 1 or better is really what we're looking for. And you were looking for fluid recommendations, right?
Yes, that was the last. So I piled them on there for you. So
no problem. I just want to make sure I'm hitting all of your points. So fluid recommendations is technically 30 milliliters per kilogram for any patient, adult or pediatric. That one always kind of bugs me because people, there's a lot of argument in the research. It's not a, we know this for a fact. It's more like a, hey, we settled on 30 because that's what the whole committee could agree wasn't, you know, half the committee said it's not enough, half the committee said it's too much. but I try and tie it into, you know, just like we talk about in the pediatric advanced life, so with the PALS recommendations for kids, right? We say 20 milliliters per kilogram per bolus, reassess, and then, you know, they may need more than that at a time. So I tend to think of it the same way. And that's still within range. Again, like anything, you want to know and follow your local protocols. But it really is that 20 to 30 range is what we're typically seeing, milliliters, 20 to 30 milliliters per kilogram to give you a ballpark. But again, these sepsis patients may be so fluid depleted in their circulatory system that it could just be they're taking liters and liters of fluid over the course of their treatment in the ambulance and in the hospital. And I will mention that, again, it's not definitive, but I personally, from the research that I'm looking at, lean towards a balanced crystalloid solution. So like a lactated Ringer's solution or plasmalite, if it's available, over normal saline, but that is not a definitive thing. It's not, oh my gosh, if you give them saline, you know, it's going to, you know, leak out of their fingers and toes. Absolutely not. Again, follow your local protocols. But these patients often, because they're getting these physiological derangements and chemical issues all over the body, that a balanced solution can help kind of keep them a little bit more on track, especially when we're giving the amount of fluids that they may get, so that no normal saline in normal pre-hospital amounts wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing in the world. But if you start that normal saline and that winds up continuing, they can really wind up leading to worsening of acidosis down the road. So I lean towards the lactated ringers.
All right. Last thing I want to call you back on. I made some notes while you were talking. It's always good when people take notes. It means they're listening. End-tidal CO2 of less than 35. I think that bears a little bit of mention again, where we have more end-tidal CO2 being measured. How valuable do you think that is in the grand scheme of things?
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of end-tidal CO2. I really look at it as, again, I get my little things that I put together. And the funny thing is I put it together for me, and then I find sometimes other people find it useful. I think of end-tidal CO2 as the MVP of vital signs. Ventilation, perfusion, and metabolism, ventilation, and perfusion, MVP, because it really gives you information on all three. People tend to see it as a breathing thing because they see the waveform and they think about the waveform, and that's fine. And they see the numbers for the respiratory rate. And yes, it does give you that. But the output of end-tidal CO2 always starts with metabolism. So if they're metabolizing properly, that should be putting out the bicarbonate into the bloodstream, traveling to the lungs, relatively unchanged. It's not like oxygenation, where oxygen can get eaten up along the way, and pulse ox, while useful, can be, I'm maybe oversimplifying it a little bit, but it can be a little bit less definitive and delayed. Whereas end-tidal CO2, what you see the patient breathing out, as long as they're not breathing super fast or super slowly, what you see the patient breathing out is reflective of their metabolism inside their body. So if they're not breathing super fast, they're not breathing off, you know, very quickly small amounts of CO2, then what you're seeing really should be in that 35 to 45 range. And if it's low, it's because their metabolism isn't producing CO2 very well, or their circulation, their perfusion, isn't perfusing and picking up that bicarbonate and moving it to the lungs to be gotten rid of. So there again, bringing it back to sepsis, end-tidal CO2 that's low, if you're looking at a patient and they're breathing in the ballpark of a normal respiratory rate, but their CO2 is low, you say, oh, sepsis is eating away at their metabolism and their perfusion. So that's why end-tidal CO2 is closely correlated to production of lactate, indications of shock, and so on.
Another great explanation. I think really the way that you explain things is going to be a hallmark of this episode. We're at the end. What I give everybody a chance to do at the end is have a last word, a message, primacy and recency. People remember what they hear first and last. You have a chance to have a message as we head out the podcast door here. What would you like to say to people as we wrap this up?
Honestly, Dan, it's be heard, spread the word, unrecognized sepsis kills. Not everything is sepsis, but most sepsis is unrecognized. You really have to spread the word, unrecognized sepsis kills. And even if you work in a system that does not have a clearly defined sepsis alert or code sepsis, say, I suspect sepsis. If you wind up getting that infection plus bad vitals, whether you're an EMT handing the patient over to a paramedic or giving a report in the emergency department, wherever, whatever it is, whoever you are, I suspect sepsis, because unrecognized sepsis kills.
All right. That was just what we were looking for there. Ram Duckworth, fire captain, EMS coordinator, and based on this, as part of the advisory board of the Sepsis Alliance, I'm sure that you made them proud here and gave everybody a really great podcast. I thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Dan.
Another episode now of Seven Things EMS comes to a close. A great one at that. Thank you for listening. This is sponsored by Limmer Education. We do have continuing education available. If you would like to take us up on that, we hope we see you back for another podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a Seven Things EMS podcast by Limmer Education. If you've listened to this podcast on a streaming service and you're interested in getting continuing education credit, please go to lc-ready.com for more information.